Podcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign, locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Christie Clinic, with offices in Champaign, Urbana, Rantoul, and Mahomet, providing quality health care to the residents of Central Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine in Urbana. This Saturday, March 13th, from 2 to 6 p.m., the Corkscrew is holding a tasting of 2002 Vintage Oregon Pinot Noirs and will feature wines from Bergstrom Winery, Ken Wright Cellars, and many others. More information is available at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com.
Welcome back to hour number two, Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the program, Harriet Williamson, Travis Dantzel, Henry Frayne is at the controls. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour of the show, we'll be talking with Mark Katz, who was a speechwriter and humorist. He actually worked as a joke writer for President Bill Clinton, and he has written a book about his experiences. The title of his book is Clinton and Me, a Real-Life Political Comedy. So we'll talk about that tomorrow morning at 10. Then in the second hour, our guest will be our own meteorologist, one of our meteorologists, Ed Kieser. He does weather here on WILO Radio, also on WILL Television. And we are now at the time of year when we're encouraging people to think about the possibility that there will be severe weather here in our area coming up in the spring. Of course, you could have a tornado any month of the year, but it's most likely in the kind of season we're moving into. So at this time of year, we like to talk a little bit about severe storms, how they work, how they're charted, and what you should do if the warning comes and you know that there's a tornado headed your way. And that's what we'll be doing tomorrow morning in the second hour of the show. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. This morning in the first hour of the show, or pardon me, I guess it's the second hour of the show, we have another candidate with us that will be involved in the primary here next Tuesday. In the congressional district here that includes Champaign-Urbana, that is the 15th congressional district, there will be a primary on the Democratic side. Our guest this morning is one of the two candidates that will be in the primary. His name is David Gill. Last week on this program, we had his primary opponent, Ralph Langenheim. He's a member of the Champaign County Board, and one of them, whoever wins the primary, will then go on to face Representative Tim Johnson, Republican, incumbent. He does not have an opponent in the primary, so he'll be the candidate. One of them, either Ralph or David Gill, will face Tim Johnson then in the general election in the fall. And in the run-up to elections, we try to have as many candidates as we can here on this program to give voters the opportunity to have some access. I have a list of questions that I'll ask, but the idea here is that people who are listening can also ask questions. The number, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let me just tell you a little bit more about our guest. He is a physician. He works in the emergency department at John Warner Hospital in Clinton, where he makes his home. He's also president of the hospital's board of directors, and he's also been involved in politics in DeWitt County for the past several years, serving as a Democratic precinct committeeman. He's a graduate of University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign, both for his college and med school, and he grew up near Chicago. He's here with us in the studio, and we're very happy to have him. And again, your questions are welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
So why do you want to run for Congress?
Well, primarily because of the fact that I've grown frustrated with the lack of response on Washington's part to the health care financing crisis that we have in this country. I've watched it for 16 years as a physician, and there seems to be utter stagnation in Washington with regards to fixing the health care problem that we have. We're the only developed nation on earth that doesn't have a national health insurance plan. And I think that many people suffer because of that.
We can get into some of this in a little bit of greater detail, but we do have a caller, and they've been waiting. So I will not make them wait any longer. We'll get right to them.
Sure.
They're in Urbana and on line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I have a comment and a question. My comment is that I am a Democrat, and Mr. Gill, what you would do if the worst thing happened and president, the current president, was reelected rather than a new president, Senator Kerry. And I wondered how you, as a Democratic candidate and as a Democratic representative, how can you work with somebody who's really so opposed to a universal health care program?
You mean would he be elected? Would he be a member
yes.
of Congress? How and would President Bush be reelected?
Right.
How would he work out that relationship?
Well,
right.
I think it would make my life more difficult to get legislation passed. I think a larger question with regards to the immediate passage of legislation would be the makeup of Congress. Were we to have a Democratic majority in the House, we might be able to pursue some items like national health care that would be more difficult with a Republican majority. Ultimately, the president would have to sign off on any bill that got put forth, and it obviously would be more difficult with a second-term President Bush than with a President Kerry, say. But I would go about my business the same way, regardless of who wins the presidential election, and pursue my same goals.
Well, let's talk about that, and I'd like to give you a chance to talk about it in a little bit more detail. Obviously, there are a number of problems we have here when it comes to health care, and one of the biggest is the fact that we have something over 40 million people in this country that don't have any health insurance. What do we do about that?
Well, it depends who's counting. The latest figures are 44 million, and that's actually that undercounts. There's actually 60 million each year who at some time of the year are lacking health insurance. Mm-hmm. At least as concerning to me are the 100 million plus who are what we refer to as underinsured, who struggle significantly to keep up with the rising premiums and copays and deductibles. And the solution as I see it, I joined a group about 12 years ago called Physicians for a National Health Plan. It's about 10,000 physicians. And the solution as they see it and as I see it is a national health insurance plan in which we developed a tax-based system. But it's very important to note that the taxes paid in by most people would be substantially less than the dollars that they're currently putting in terms of their share of premiums and copays and deductibles. The plan as envisioned by PNHP, Physicians for a National Health Plan, would involve a 2% tax on earnings. So for the average family, that would amount to roughly $700 to $800 a year. They also speak of a payroll tax of 7%, which is if an employer is currently buying health insurance, that 7% figure is somewhat less on average than what most employers are currently kicking in for their share of health insurance. And that money would suffice. And the reason that money would suffice is because you would have greatly increased efficiency with one insurance company, so to speak, as opposed to 1,500 health insurance companies. As it is today, 25 to 30 cents out of each dollar spent on health care actually doesn't go into health care. It goes into paperwork and profiteering. And by recouping that money, that money alone would be sufficient to cover the uninsured. And it's a program that's been looked at repeatedly by the Congressional Budget Office and the General Accounting Office. And every time they come back with the same report, saying essentially, great idea. You'd save $150 billion annually for the nation as a whole. And actually, that keeps going up. Their most recent report, they indicated that we'd save $286 billion by implementing a program such as that. So it's not only is it a compassionate type of program, it's also very fiscally conservative for the country as a whole and for 90-95% of households would save substantially under a program like this.
One of the things that I think that a lot of physicians who work in managed care structures complain about is that they say their ability to deliver what they consider to be appropriate care to their patients is in some cases limited by accountants, essentially, guys who are looking at numbers and saying, you can only do this, you can provide this much care, you can do this procedure, but not this procedure, who are actually looking at the bottom line. Do you feel confident as a physician that a system like this would not have the same problem, that there would be essentially some accountant looking over your shoulder telling you what you can and cannot do for your patients?
Yes. In fact, that's one of the things that Physicians for a National Health Plan points out about the program that they propose, that that's one of the myths out there, that Uncle Sam would be dictating how medicine is practiced. In fact, it's the case today that physicians are dictated to how medicine will be practiced by people that don't know much about, much or anything about medicine. Under the type of program that I'm proposing and that Physicians for a National Health Plan are proposing, the only role of the federal government would be to serve as a bank. The money would be collected by Uncle Sam, and the money would be distributed by Uncle Sam. As they see it, there would be regional boards that would negotiate once every couple years with hospitals, physician practices, and set a budget for them, and that would be it. It would then be up to the physicians to practice medicine as they saw fit, and the hospitals to perform as they see fit.
People, I think, now who are concerned about this kind of plan talk about the problem or the possibility of rationing of care. Now, for I think probably a lot of people in this country who do have health insurance, they're in some kind of managed care situation where, in fact, that's whether they think about it or not, that's already happening.
We ration care
you,
today,
you ration
every day.
Care today, every day. Uh-huh. But I guess I wonder whether if such a system was implemented, if people would actually notice the difference, and how many people would say, well, this is different than what I had before.
I think it's more of a theoretical problem. When you look at real-life experience in the countries in Europe and in Canada and in Japan who have systems similar to the type of program that I'm talking about, number one, those people live longer than we do. Their life expectancy is greater than ours. And when you look at the measures of healthcare quality, the World Health Organization comes out with a report every several years with regards to healthcare quality. And we most recently got ranked 37th in the world in terms of healthcare quality. There's a lot of room for improvement. The countries that have the types of programs that I'm talking about score much higher than we do in terms of healthcare quality. So it almost becomes a moot point as to in what fashion rationing occurs. The ultimate question is the end result. How do people live and how long do they live? How well do they live and how long do they live?
We have some callers. So we're getting some other folks lined up here, and perhaps I should introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, David Gill. He is a Democratic candidate for Congress, or would like to be a Democratic candidate for Congress in the 15th Congressional District. Next week's primary, there will be a primary in the 15th between two Democrats, David Gill and Ralph Langenheim. Ralph Langenheim was here on the program last week, and people got a chance to talk with him, and we're doing the same exercise here this morning with David Gill. Then one of them, whoever wins the primary, then we'll go on to face the incumbent Republican Tim Johnson in the general election. So this is your opportunity to ask questions. If there's a particular issue that you that's really important to you, you'd like to know how the candidate stands, you give us a call, 333-9455. That's for people here just in Champaign-Urbana. We do, of course, have a toll-free line, and that means that if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. The call's on us, 800-222-9455. We have next caller in Martinsville, and this is line one.
Yes,
hello.
Thank you.
Yes.
There are a considerable number of producing oil wells in the 15th District, and I heard on the news this morning that the trade deficit is at a record level, and a large part of that, it was mentioned, was due to oil imports. Do you place any importance on the need to increase oil production in the state of Illinois as well as the rest of the United States?
I think that would be it would be nice if we could do that in a cost-efficient manner. I'm more interested in developing our use of renewable resources such as wind and solar power. But oil is important, and it's important to our local economy as well. If we could improve our use of Illinois oil, I think that ultimately we do need to be somewhat more future oriented, and recognize that there are finite amounts of fossil fuels on this planet, and that it is quite feasible to begin to use to a greater extent things such as solar and wind power and geothermal energy. In Iowa today, they get 17% of their energy from wind power alone. And I would like to see us, rather than offering $23 billion tax breaks to the oil industry, as was proposed last year and has passed the House but didn't get through the Senate, I'd like to see that type of tax policy be favored toward those who would invest in and grow the renewable resource type of energy.
One of the provisions in the proposed energy bill is to offer what they call a counter-cyclical tax credit to domestic oil production when oil prices fall quite low. So would you not favor that type of a tax credit for the oil industry when prices are low and it's difficult to meet your costs of running your business?
Well, to be honest, I'm not familiar with that type of tax credit. I do think if the choice is between imported oil and American oil, I think it's all to our benefit to use our own. You know, when we get so heavily focused upon foreign oil, it starts to impact upon our foreign policy, as I'm sure you're aware.
Mm-hmm.
I think that where we can use American, it's all to our benefit for a number of reasons.
Okay, and finally, what is your stance on opening the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, the coastal plain, to drilling and development? It's estimated that it contains 15 billion barrels of recoverable oil.
I'm against it. I think that there are very few pristine areas left in this world, particularly in our country. And I think it's guesswork with regards to how much oil is there, but some of the numbers that I hear in terms of supply are anywhere from a 6 month to a 2 year supply. And again, if you're thinking about future generations, I think some things are best left alone, like the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
And along those lines, I operate in an oil field with roughly 10 million barrels of estimated reserves, which accounts for a 12-hour supply for the United States. So you think I should just give it up and plug the wells out since that is very little oil?
Well, you're already there, right?
I mean, yeah.
There's nothing pristine there. Now I would take it.
Well, it's quite a beautiful area.
Uh-huh. But
I'd invite you to come down, in fact.
Martinsville, you say?
Yes, sir.
I hope to get there.
Okay, great. Hey, thank you much.
Right, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
We'll go on to Belgium, over by Danville, line number two. Hello.
Hello, sir. I'd like to address your guest about this aspect of his comments. Every medical professional I talk to says, we have the best medical facilities in the world, but you just mentioned that we're 37th in the list, which somebody means somebody's wrong. But all the medical professionals I ever come across are very, very dead set against quote-unquote socialized medicine or whatever form that may take in the United States. Obviously, that might be pretty much for their own self-interest, and I understand you want to make a living. But how are you going to square that, sir?
I've seen an interesting evolution over the last 10 or 12 years with regards to physicians' attitudes. Back in the early 90s, I did feel like something of a lone voice in the wilderness. But it's been interesting watching things change as the years have gone by. And I also speak to a large number of healthcare professionals. And gradually, more and more of them have been buying into the type of program that I'm talking about. I would estimate that it's somewhere between a third and a half would be supportive of the type of program I'm talking about, they would still make a very good income. You might see some shrinking as far as the disparity between different specialties, but physicians would come out just fine with the type of program that I'm talking about. In individual cases, we do have the best medicine in the world. You know, there's emirs and potentates and princes who come from all parts of the world to come to America for their health care problems. But it's when you look at the care of 280 million people, which is where the system starts to fall apart, or the lack of a system starts to take its toll, and where we begin to suffer as far as being able to have an equitable distribution of that health care.
I think you mentioned a very important aspect there, that it was the emirs and the sultanates and the extremely wealthy that want to come to this country and afford the very best. Unfortunately, like you point out, us who don't have that kind of finance don't receive that kind of care.
Exactly.
I hope you work in that direction. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome here on the program in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have that toll-free line, and that means if it would be long-distance call, we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. Let me ask you one more healthcare question. A big piece of what we spend on health care goes to pay for prescription drugs.
Mm-hmm.
They're very expensive, and particularly if we have people who are taking a number of them, it can be an awful lot of money. Is there something that the federal government can do or should do to put any kind of lid on the cost of prescription medicine?
In a nutshell. I think the first thing that we shouldn't do is what happened with the Medicare drug bill that went through a few months ago, in which we stated that explicitly that the federal government could not negotiate with the drug companies with regards to prices. Even now, with Medicare and certainly with a national health insurance program, you have tremendous purchasing power with tens of millions or couple hundred million people, and to not use that purchasing power is a mistake. If you have the type of program that I'm talking about, you know, you could turn to a drug company and say, we have 250 million customers. We'll make sure that you turn some profit, but let's see your books, and here's what we'll offer you for this cholesterol-lowering medication. Mm-hmm. And it almost becomes a take-it-or-leave-it type thing for the drug company. When you have that many people within the system.
In the meantime, would you favor giving people the opportunity to buy their prescription medicines in Canada?
Certainly, yeah. most of those come with the wrappings still intact. I think that the arguments against importing medication from Canada are pretty disingenuous and don't really speak to the actual health benefits or downsides to the medication.
Some people, as you say, the concerns that seem to be raised, in fact, I think the concerns that are expressed by the federal government, are that people might be buying a medication that was not mm-hmm. getting what they think that they're paying for, that it may not be genuine, that it may be poorly manufactured, a whole list of things that they say, we are worried that if you fill your prescription that way, you're not going to get what you should be getting. As a physician, you don't have that worry?
No. I mean, when it comes in the same bottle, in the same box, with the same plastic wrapping, from the same factory as what is sold here, I think that argument doesn't hold much water.
We have some other folks here, and I think the next person in line is calling on a cell phone, so we'll get right to them on line one. Hello.
Hi. There's a couple things about the health care proposal. I'm sorry that I missed the first few minutes of the program and didn't hear the exact details of Mr. Gill's proposal, but just a couple comments for what people have said and what the questions you've asked, David. The gentleman who called from Martinsville about the opposition of physicians to the program, I mean, you didn't mention that there's a rather large organization called Physicians for a Single Payer Healthcare Program or something like that. And I don't know how many members they have, but it's quite a fairly large organization of physicians who support the program. And so that caller might want to look for their website or something and find some physicians who have different opinions than the ones he's talking to. The other thing, you were talking about rationing, the idea of rationing, and I just wanted to summarize some of the things you said by pointing out that we have rationing now not just within the various health maintenance organizations and so on, but we have rationing. It goes on all the time in the United States. It just has to do with whether you have an employer or you personally can afford health insurance or not. Hello?
Yes. Yes, we're here. Okay, we're here.
I'm sorry. I know I'm sort of just lecturing and not, I couldn't tell if I had lost you on my cell phone. And then I just want to tell the following story, which is I actually lived in Canada in the early 90s when the debate over the sort of Clinton health care reform proposals were going on. And I remember watching on American television these ads from the Harry and Louise ads or whatever they were called about, oh, you're going to have to, you're not going to get to choose your own doctors and you're going to have to wait for everything and so on and so forth. And the irony was that when I moved to Canada, I asked some people for some recommendations for a physician. The one that seemed the best recommendation, I called up, was able to go see right away, and got an appointment that afternoon, so no waiting, never waited for any health care services that I ever needed. When I moved back to the United States and started, got into an employer was paying for an HMO, I had to call five physicians, none of whom were taking patients, and finally just sort of got assigned someone by the HMO. I called to get an appointment for a checkup and just to meet the physician. I called in November, and they scheduled the first available appointment was in February.
Right.
So all of the things, all of that supposedly the single-payer systems were having as problems were not problems there and were problems here. So I'm glad to hear that you're supporting some program like that, from what I could tell from the parts that I did hear, and I wish you a lot of luck with that.
I appreciate that. I agree with everything that you had to say, and you're welcome to come with me on the campaign trail anytime. That group is Physicians for a National Health Plan. It is almost 10,000 doctors strong. May I mention the website?
Yeah, of course.
It's pnhp.org. There are many, many physicians who have strong feelings about this, similar to my types of feelings.
We are a little bit past our midpoint here. We have some other callers we'll get right to. I just want to introduce again our guest for anyone who might have tuned in. We're talking this morning with David Gill. He is one of two Democrats seeking their party's nomination to run for representative in the 15th Congressional District. His opponent in next week's primary, Ralph Langenheim, is a member of the Champaign County Board. He was here on the program last week, and we want to give you the same opportunity to hear now from the other of the two candidates. One of them, whoever wins the primary, goes on to face the incumbent Representative Tim Johnson. A little bit more, again, in terms of background on our guest. He's a physician. He works as medical director in the emergency department at John Warner Hospital in Clinton, where he makes his home. He's also president of that hospital's board of directors. He grew up near Chicago and is a graduate of the U of I for both college and med school. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our next caller, I believe, should be in Buckley on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm also sorry I missed the first part of your program, because you might have covered one of my questions. But I'll ask both my questions and then hang up and listen on the radio.
Okay.
The first is my husband and I just had a baby, and we found one of the things about the medical system that we had a problem with were tests that are done somewhat needlessly to ward off lawsuits. And my husband and I farm, we're self-employed, we have our own insurance, and we found out too late that we don't have maternity coverage. So we're self-pay, and that, these are one to $1,500 tests that are paid out of pocket for us. And so that's one thing that I'd like you to address, is different ideas for bringing down health care costs, you know, that are more geared towards lawsuits than, you know, insurance. And then the other is when we went to pay, it became clear that our costs are higher as self-pay than the insurance companies, because the insurance companies apparently get discounts that hospitals and clinic associations won't give to self-pay people who are above a certain income level. And so I don't know if that's part of your plan, but if you could address those two things. Have I made them clear?
Yes, very much so.
Okay. I'll listen on the radio. Thanks.
Thank you for the call. I think really what we're talking about in the first case is we're talking about the cost of malpractice insurance that doctors have to pay, which is something I know a lot of physicians are very concerned about.
Right.
That they would say, well, maybe the reason we're doing tests that we otherwise wouldn't do is because we want to have that protection, because it can be extremely costly if you end up getting sued. And that, you know, so there's this atmosphere of litigation that surrounds medicine. And related to that, indeed, is this problem of for physicians, very high cost of what they have to pay for their malpractice insurance.
Right. It's a problem. And it's something that I deal with. My malpractice premium has doubled over the last 3 years without significant claims as yet against me. I don't think that the status quo is good. Some people within my political party get upset with me when I discuss tort reform as it applies to medical malpractice. But I think that something needs to be done. I've sat down and visited with a number of trial attorneys, and I don't have the precise answer. I do think that a $250,000 cap on non-economic damages, as proposed by President Bush and the Republican Congress, is not the answer. That's going to lock a lot of people out of the system. There's going to be a lot of people that have difficulty finding an attorney when there's that little award to be had in some significant losses. We certainly make mistakes, physicians in hospitals. I won't deny that. One thing that I would tell this caller, first of all, I would say congratulations on the baby. I would say that any of those tests, you should have the power to approve or disapprove any test that's done. That's separate and apart from any type of healthcare system. If you choose to refuse a test, you have that right. We've had a number of farmers and small business people get excited about the campaign and sign on doing volunteer work for us. I've been reaching out to traditionally Republican niches, getting in touch with a lot of farm groups and rotary groups, because you're exactly right. When you're trying to purchase insurance on your own or pay these things out of pocket, it's very difficult. And it's those people in particular that could really use a change in the type of healthcare system that we have. Getting back to the malpractice question, I've heard a number of creative answers to our crisis, and I'm not sure just which one is right, but I think as long as one is open-minded and recognizes that the status quo is not sound and that we do engage in a lot of needless defensive medicine that is very costly, I think that we can find something that works for everybody, for the patients and for physicians and for attorneys and for insurance companies.
Okay. I hope that gets at the questions of the caller. Let's take another one. Fairmount is next, line 3. Hello.
Hi, I've got a question about farm subsidy and entitlement payments. If you're proposing national health care, that sounds like another expensive entitlement payment. Are you in favor of keeping all the other ones with entitlement payments? And I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
Entitlements, I suppose he means as they apply to farm subsidies?
I would assume so, that he's specifically interested in that, yes, as it applies to agriculture, I guess. Now, and I suppose the other question is, well, are you really, when you talk about health care, Would you use a word like entitlement? It sounds like what you're proposing is more of a pay as you. I mean, that people will pay in, everybody will pay into the system, and it's going to be tax supported.
Everybody so, who's earning money.
So,
and everybody would be covered by the system.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would use the word entitlement. It's a philosophical thing. It's where myself and many others feel that healthcare should be a right. That I'm a capitalist, but there are some few issues that are more important than the almighty dollar, and one of those is life and death, which is what healthcare is all about. With regards to other entitlements, our tax policy is largely geared to favor the large agribusiness conglomerates rather than the small family farmer, and I would like to see us look out for the small family farmer. I used to live in a farm community, Delavan, and it's I don't need to tell this gentleman that it's hard to make ends meet farming these days, and so I think whatever steps that can be taken to preserve small farms ought to be taken.
All right. Urbana, next, line two. Hello.
Yeah. The use of the word entitlement, I hope you get in the habit of stomping on people who use it, because it's really the kind of language your insurance company uses when they don't want to pay a claim. You know, Social Security is not an entitlement. It's more like an insurance policy. But anyway, I wanted to hear you talk about any thoughts you might have about long-term care. There's going to be a huge baby boomer crowd getting up there, when a lot of them are going to have Alzheimer's. What do you have any ideas about that? And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
You're right. It's a huge issue, and it's something within the context of the plan that I've been describing. It's covered. Mental health care is covered on a par with all other ailments. Long-term care is covered. All of this is coverable. You know, we spend more than twice per person on health care in this country as anywhere else. As it is, we put all kinds of dollars into healthcare, but again, with not any extra special return. Like I said, our life expectancy is a little bit less than most of the other developed countries, and healthcare quality is lacking. And so the money is there for long-term coverage, it's doable. It's doable right now with regards to the dollars that we put into our system. It's just a question of enacting a system that makes sense.
Next caller is Charleston, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I'm calling about the health care issue. I don't really understand why it's a Republican or a Democratic one, because everybody will need health care at some point.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I'm all for you, and I'm all for your plan. I know that if we had a universal plan, it would cost less, not more, and that the patient would have a lot more protection than what they have now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to take just a second to put in a plug about Illinois. Illinois is trying to pass the Health Care Justice Act, and it only lacked one vote in the Senate last fall. And it's going to come up for a vote again. And, if you were the senator instead of Mr. Winkle, maybe Illinois would be like Saskatchewan in Canada and lead the country towards a more sensible system. But I still wish you the best in your campaign as well. In fact, if people want to know more about that, the Campaign for Better Health Care, locally, cbhconline.org has information about it. But about that girl that just called, she was talking about how different people pay different prices for different things. Well, that's part of the problem, I think, is that there's absolutely no transparency. Nobody knows who's paying how much for what. But there was a lawsuit brought and won in Northern Illinois that claimed that this wasn't fair. Lisa Madigan is trying to get on top of this issue to some extent, and there is a Republican proposal at the national level to make it okay for hospitals to charge different amounts for the same thing. So there's different things going on as far as that's concerned. And then one question for you about the malpractice.
Mm-hmm.
I saw Dick Durbin on C-SPAN the other day, and he had chart after chart after chart showing that the few states that have put caps on malpractice awards, that it has not affected the cost of malpractice insurance. And do you think it's possible that insurance companies could be gouging the malpractice premium, just like I think they're gouging the health care premium? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I appreciate all your comments, and I agree that this really isn't a Democrat versus Republican type issue. In fact, I've been saying for the last few months that any time now the Republicans are going to come and co-opt my issue because it makes so much sense, and because we're getting so much enthusiasm and support from people all across the political spectrum. For the last few weeks, I've been telling people that you're striking at the heart of the matter there when you talk about the insurance companies when it comes to the malpractice crisis. I hear it from both sides. I hear it from within my profession. I get told by the insurance carrier that we can't make ends meet because of the large awards that are given out. And from the other side, the trial lawyers, they say, no, 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 the insurance company has just made bad investments, and that's why they're suffering. And I think that, is there gouging? I don't know, but I at least am at the point where I recognize now that to get to the crux of this matter, one needs to see the books of the malpractice carriers and see just where their money's coming from and where it's going. And once that's done, we'd have a better understanding of just what the problem is and where the problem lies.
All right, let's go again to another caller. Next up is Champagne and line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I'd like for your guest to address Family Values, his views, and how he would vote on abortion and also on marriage between being between a man and a woman and also euthanasia. And I'll hang up and listen on the air.
All right.
I'm in favor of family values. I'm still married to my first wife, and we have 3 children, a traditional nuclear family. I think there are all kinds of family situations that work well for different people. I am pro-choice with regards to your first question, which is different than pro-abortion. I do think that the types of education and healthcare issues that I believe in would result in a drastic diminishing of the number of unwanted pregnancies in this country, which in itself would result in a great cut in the number of abortions that are desired or obtained here in America. You asked about gay marriage. And I do not favor a constitutional amendment that outlaws gay marriage. I think that when two men get married or two women get married, it does no harm to the marriage between my wife and I or between any other couple. And with regards to euthanasia, euthanasia is a pejorative term. I don't think that euthanasia is something that should be legalized. I do think that people should have autonomy over what happens to their own bodies. Oregon has a law which was passed by voter referendum twice in which they refer to death with dignity, where if there's a terminal patient suffering terribly, they can go to their physician and obtain a prescription for a barbiturate to take if and when they choose to leave this world of their own volition. There are a number of hoops to jump through. There are a number of safeguards. There's about a dozen steps that need to be taken with regards to that Oregon law. Two physicians have to see the patient. There's a waiting period. A psychiatrist has to see the patient to make sure they're not simply depressed. And with that number of safeguards, I think it's a law that works reasonably well. It gets used 20 to 30 times each year. Far more often, people obtain the prescription, but then wind up not even using it. They know that they have severe abdominal pain from their pancreatic cancer, and the typical case is a patient who is gritting their teeth and saying, "I can stand it now, but should it get worse than this, I might need it. I might need an out." And so that's how it is in Oregon, and I think it's something that makes sense. It's something I would like to see available to people that live in the other 49 states, although I don't, there's certainly not the clamoring for that that there seems to be for national health insurance.
We've been talking a lot about health issues, and mm-hmm. I want to move on and talk maybe in a little bit more general way about the economy. People obviously remember back. We know that we went into recession probably sometime into 2000. Then, of course, things got worse because the terrorist attacks in 2001. Technically, we're not in recession anymore. That ended. However, the growth rate of the economy has continued to be pretty anemic, and people are not happy. It's maybe last year was a little bit better, but the end of the year, it was 4.5% or something. And we've lost in the last 4 years. We lost a lot of jobs. We're adding some back, but nothing near at the rate of which we lost. So then we come to the question was, okay, federal government, what can the Congress do? Is there anything the Congress can do to stimulate the economy and to encourage the creation of new jobs?
Well, a couple of steps come immediately to mind. First of all, We were told with each of the last three tax cuts that were pushed through by Representative Johnson and by President Bush that those would create jobs. And in fact, that didn't happen. And we saw the same thing not happen a generation ago with President Reagan. And it surprised me when they did it the first time. It shocked me when they did it the second time when they hadn't created any jobs. And with the third tax cut, you know, as you note, there haven't been jobs created by these tax cuts. And all that it has done is created a tremendous deficit, which is a drain on our economy. It's an awful thing to leave to our children and grandchildren, and it's also a tough thing for us here today. The interest payment on our debt is a very substantial number, and it also results in cuts in funding for programs that are needed. So I think repealing those tax cuts as they apply to the very wealthy in our society, you know, those making $250,000 a year or more, would be a first step toward reinvigorating the economy to some extent. The other problem, as I see it, is NAFTA and the various trade agreements that we've entered into since NAFTA that are based upon NAFTA, GATT and the like. Ross Perot said it best back in the presidential debates before '92. When he warned us that if we got into that type of agreement, the giant sucking sound we'd hear would be that of jobs going overseas. We see it in Clinton. We've had three manufacturing plants close up in the last 3 to 4 years, go to places like Indonesia, where they can pay their workers 17 cents an hour, 31 cents an hour. And I think that we need to withdraw or renegotiate from those types of trade agreements and get into trade agreements that focus on worker rights and human rights and the environment for the well-being of our workers and our jobs as well as the well-being of workers around the globe.
Should the federal government do something to discourage American businesses from exporting jobs?
Very much so. You know, as it is now, it's to me, it's completely turned upside down. There's tax breaks to the companies that are going overseas, and you could do it just the opposite. There can be tax penalties for those that are going overseas. There can be tax breaks for those that are keeping jobs here and creating jobs here. And tax policy drives behavior to a large extent in a large number of areas.
President Bush has proposed a program that would create a guest worker program for the United States, making it possible for people either who are undocumented people who are here to stay here and work for a period of years, or for people outside the United States to apply to come. Mm-hmm. And he says that it's simply to provide workers for jobs that Americans, he says, don't want. And not intended to make it any easier for those people to become citizens, merely to have to work here for those 3 years. And at the end of the 3 years, then
there's no promises.
Yeah, right. That's right. That's right. What do you think about that proposal?
I think it's unfair both to the Americans and to the foreign workers. I know a lot of workers within the 15th district as I've traveled around the 22 counties for the last 15 months who would be glad to take those jobs that he says workers are not interested in. And I think it's unfair to the foreigners where he's using their, in a sense, they'll get used with no ultimate offer of citizenship at the end of the road. He's just, they're being laid open to being used by corporations at relatively low wages and poor benefits.
Are you concerned about the future of Social Security?
Very much so. Very, very much so. I think that's one area where I differ from some of the people within my party. I don't push for any particular retirement age in particular. I just say that to stick our head in the sand and to ignore the demographics of our society, the fact that we're aging substantially, we ignore that fact at our own peril. And Alan Greenspan was rather direct in his comments, but some of what he was talking about a couple of weeks back was actually truth, in my opinion. We're getting very old. We're asking a smaller and smaller number of workers to take care of a growing and growing number of retirees, and we need to at least look at that and reassess what we're going to do about that.
Okay. Well, we're going to leave it there with our, again, our thanks to our guest, David Gill. He is one of two Democrats. The other is Ralph Langenheim. They'll be competing in the primary next week here in Illinois in the 15th Congressional District. Then one of them will go on to face the incumbent Republican, Tim Johnson. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me here. It was a pleasure.
Our show, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Programming is also made possible by Strawberry Fields and West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, and supplements, as well as a full deli, coffee bar, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. And that's it for us here on Focus. Where we go again, a reminder that tomorrow morning on the program in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll be talking with Mark Katz, former presidential speechwriter and humorist. He actually worked as a joke writer, believe it or not, for Bill Clinton, and he's written a book about his experiences titled Clinton and Me, A Real-Life Political Comedy. Then in the second hour, our guest will be Ed Kieser, our meteorologist, and we'll talk a little bit about getting ready for the kind of severe storms, thunderstorms, and tornadoes we know we'll have here this spring. That's tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. And we always welcome your questions and comments, and we hope that you'll stay tuned because up next is the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll feature an archive interview with the man who leaked the Pentagon Papers, Daniel Ellsberg. That's coming up today at 1:06 Central Time. We'll get underway at noon with news from National Public Radio, the BBC, and AM 580. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. March wheat trading at 359, down 4. July wheat, 366, down 7. March corn, 291 and 3/4, down 3 and